we should get going. My name is Jane Bennett, and I work at the Adult and Gender Institute. And I want to welcome everybody to one of what is a series of what we try and put together, which we call Talking the Walk, a set of, sometimes it's talks, sometimes it's book launches, sometimes it's movies, sometimes it's digital narratives, in which what we try to do is honor and set into conversation the work that some of us are doing to realize political vision. And those political visions aren't identical, and they don't come from the same places. But what they do is insist that it is always possible to negotiate voice and to negotiate power. And we are deeply honored to have with us Sarah Longway, who I'm going to introduce at deeper length in a moment. Deeper length. But before I get there, I also want to give a particular welcome to the Honours and Master students in the African Gender Institute's Gender and Transformation Program, and to the postgraduate students at the University of the Western Cape's Program in Women and Gender Studies. And I want to do that because, firstly, yes, it is now nearly, the year is now nearly over. We know that. For a long time, it was just beginning, so you didn't need to worry. Now it's nearly over, and it's panic stations. So this seemed an absolutely perfect point for us to celebrate your decisions to make a certain area of intellectual and imaginative work your political lives of the mind. You have lives of the body, you have lives of the heart, you have lives of the spirit, but you've taken a step towards an engagement with writing and being and discovery that quite often is stigmatized by the people you know. What are you going to do with it? And you have to answer questions about that, that perhaps if you were registered in other spaces, in other contexts, you wouldn't have to face. And that means that no matter what else we find to honor in your different courages and interests and the way you challenge the rest of us, we also have to honor that you are the spaces, the bodies, the voices, which often make it possible for somebody like me, somebody like Yaliwe, somebody like Desiree, to do our work. It's not that our work is confined to universities, but without you, we wouldn't be here either, and we certainly wouldn't be here in the positions of challenge and persuasion. We do a lot of persuading that we are. So thank you very much for coming. We are delighted to be able to share this chilly evening with you. And one of the contributing threads that made it all come together, you people who've come into the space through our advertisements. We're very grateful for that. And we know of at least, because she told me, at least one person who came here because of Sarah's interview on the radio this morning. So who says that SMSs are the way to go? Radio is still right there. And we also have a publication, Feminist Africa. It's an academic journal, although it tries to push the boundaries of that in some ways. And about a year ago, a few of us, 8, 9, from around the continent, got together to talk about what we called legal voice. We were looking at the fact that within many of our contexts, some of the hardest work done to instantiate even the basic terms of personhood for people who are women, for people who are lesbian, for people who are transgendered, for people who are gay, for people who are migrant workers, for people who suddenly get called refugees when they were once called doctors or architects or school teachers, that work has involved the legal. Sometimes that's been because of the limits of the imagination of the state and of the movement into post so-called colonial post-flag democratic spaces, but actually that was a legal entity, so that's what you did, you worked with the law. And there were very, very important reasons to do that, particularly a space like South Africa. But it's also a zone that can be seen as an elitist zone. It's a zone that's very dense. It's a zone that requires very many resources for training. And it speaks to itself, right? And yet the issues that it deals with are issues that relate to all of us every day. And we wanted to explore what it would might mean to talk about African feminisms, meaning African contextually based feminisms, that had taken on the law. Was it true, for example, that you could only do that if you were already an important legal figure with a lot of money? Was that true? Was it true that even if you pushed a law reform and you nearly broke your back in doing it, that it didn't really matter? There's always a gap, a gap between policy and implementation. Yeah, for sure, for sure, for sure. We know about the gap. But what did it take to actually do that work? And what do we need to think about it? And particularly in a space like South Africa, as we see legal spaces being threatened, ones we thought were quite solid in the protection of certain fundamental rights, being challenged, rolled back. It seemed to us time to think about this. We did. A group of amazing people came together. Sarah was one of them. Huda was another one. Where's Huda? There she is. Huda Abrams back here from the Women's Legal Center. We talked and we wrote. Some of what we wrote came into Feminist Africa. It's an unusual edition. It's much less academic than the others, although there are some amazing pieces that do follow that genre as well. You've got to be patient to read some of the pieces, and we did that on purpose. It's like, gosh, you made that argument, and then you made that argument, and they said this, and then they said that, and you made that argument, and that, and that. My God, is this ever going to end? Sure, this end of the story. You made that argument, and then they said, but that's how it is. That's how it is in that space. That's how it is. It's not the drama of, yes, we did this, or no, we didn't. It's micro. It's micro. It's micro. It's very, very intensely demanding work. So some of what people have written reflects a sense of that micro-political space. Sarah Longway has written in the piece about one of her particular journeys. She's very well known across the continent and beyond. She's an international activist. She's certainly worked with law. She's worked with rights. She's worked in the space of development. Some of you may know her from being students as being the author of the development framework, which challenged those of Harvard and other places very successfully. And she's also the most extraordinary woman. The AGI owes her a particular debt because we get the honor of working with her daughter. But what she has mothered and brought to bear has not only been daughters and grandchildren, it's been a whole tradition of what it means to live your life constantly as a feminist activist. A couple of days ago, I mean, I'm going to stop, and a couple of days ago, Yaliwe wasn't here, she was in Uganda, and we were looking for Sarah, so because of the radio interview. So I emailed her son. He said, awfully sorry, where's your mother? And he wrote back immediately, she's here. If you can't get her there, try this. If you can't get her there, there's my phone number. And also, you know, let me know if you have any problems. Love from the son of a feminist mother. So I think it's extremely exciting that she's with us. And I'm going to invite you to talk to us for a little while.
Okay. Oh, I don't know how I live up to all that, but anyway, that's how I'm feeling about me, so let me give you what you think of me. Anyway, the issue is that the law might be there, very explicit, But when it comes to actually attaining that protection, somehow when it comes to a woman, a female human being, it's very, very difficult, even when you can see very easily that here there's abrogation of one's rights. But there was one day in February of 1984, I had gone to pick up my two children who were having a birthday party there with their friends from school. We were a bit late, and one of those children was Yaliwe. She was only 10 then. But I thought it would be an easy thing, just walking in, grab my children, were late, and apologize to my friends and go out. No, as we pulled up at the Intercontinental Hotel in Osaka, it's huge, it's got a foyer and everything, you can drive into it. And I alight, which I thought I was doing, left my toddler, the brother, Yaliwe, who was then only two, I think, left him on the chair and dashed in. But of course we knew that hotels do, posh ones, have sort of come up with another way of discriminating against the people of different status. I mean, before independence, although this was 22 years later, they did have this right of admission where they would keep anyone that they didn't want. They kept the blacks away. But now, after independence, they could keep women away. So that's how I interpret it. You know, they kept the same principle of discrimination, but this time it came down to keep the women out. So this security guard said, murmured something. So I thought it was impolite to just go on and not reply. So I said, yeah, what did you say? And I said, oh, you can't go in, madam. I said, what? So, well, you are unaccompanied. And I knew they did that. But I didn't think it would happen to me. So I was so annoyed, very offended. You know, I said, what have I done? You know, so I just shrugged it off because I thought it was rubbish. I said, rubbish. Just like the rubbish, and I'm running in because I'm late. You know, the next thing, I couldn't move. You know, the guy had grabbed my arm, my loose rubbish arm. So I turned around in such a way, I knew what had happened now. I said, okay, it's come to this, now what shall I do? So I came around in such a way that I became loose, you know, I was detached from him. And then he realized, and we both realized, I was so surprised that I was loose. Instead of running, I just kept staring at him. Then he dashed for me, and I said, uh-oh. So this time I sent a punch. I had done karate in a yellow belt. So he instinctively stooped, because he had a hat, to pick up the hat. And then I remembered, you know, he was doing it karate for self-defense, to say, you just disarm and get away. So I said, oh, that happened this time properly, because he was facing down, you know, I could turn around and rush in. I did rush in, and he followed me, but looking for the hotel duty manager and so forth, finally got him, and I was really furious. And I was very surprised, you know, when he said, yes, he's just doing his duty. I said, duty? You've been accosting people. He says, doing his duty because you are unaccompanied. Unaccompanied, what do you mean? No, you are not in the company of a male. I said, no. Oh, dawned on me again, this is what is happening in the posh hotels. So I said, even accosting then is also part of the rule? He says, no. So at that point, we tend to better protection. Since I couldn't get protection from the hotel, I thought, now I'll get protection from the state police. So, because they say that is an assault. So I realized I couldn't at the same time be present and go and get the police. So the children had come, the girls had come with their mother's friend, and I apologized. I found me in a big argument. So I sent Yaliwe and Tuani to go and get their father so that he can come and go and get the police, which he duly did. When the police came, they, you know, looking for this woman who'd been assaulted, and asking him to point, where is the woman? Of course, maybe he thought he would point at the guest, at the mother of the friend, because she was from Scandinavia, blonde and everything. So I think that's one they thought he might point to. But when he pointed to me, they just burst into laughter. So then I realized we're going back again. 22 years, you know, the calabar was back in place because they didn't take it seriously. But I wondered why they came all the way there if they didn't believe that actually his wife had been accosted. So instead of taking a statement, because we were laughing, I said, you better take a statement. This is the guy who has assaulted me, and he's even nodding. I said, yes, because she decided to continue and so forth. They said I was making a nuisance, a public nuisance, and they would arrest me. So after one or two arguments, I realized it wasn't going anywhere. But luckily, they said, you can report anywhere, because I insisted, are you sure you don't want to take this statement? I physically been assaulted. They said, where are the bruises? You know. So when they said, you can report anywhere, I said, there's another exit and continuation. I said, okay, so who do I tell? I said, everybody, anybody you want to. I said, okay, then I need names of the police officers that have refused to record a felony which has happened. And the one of them was senior, not four, but he pointed to me, Mori, a junior person, to give the name. So at least I had a name. Of course, we all left the place because they were becoming really, really aggressive, because we also had a Pan-African meeting in that, most of the delegates were staying in that hotel. So my shouting and saying, discriminated against me, you know, wasn't going down very well. So we went home, but I continued to be so angry. So I wasn't going to rest until I report to somebody, because something wrong. So I decided on writing a letter to the Women's League. We won party state in 1984 then, and copied it to various other authorities who might be interested, and I thought it was their area of operation, but I only mentioned two of these. The Women's League, of course, who were the main addressee, didn't do anything. Instead, they started quarreling among themselves on whether I had a complaint or not. But the other one, whom I really thought I'd get action from, just in case these people don't act, was the Ombuds, the Investigator General. Here you have an Ombuds, or you call the Protector. Maybe in South Africa you call that person the Protector. So I called upon them because the Women's League at the time, they were quarreling, saying the Secretary General was on my... was thinking the same way I was thinking, that was freedom of association and freedom of expression and so forth. You know, that I was free to go anywhere I wanted. But her boss, who was the chairperson of the Women's League, you know, was against the idea. He says, no. She actually congratulated the police. I mean, and congratulated the hotel for doing that. He says, keeping out these home breakers. Because why should a woman go to the hotel by herself? She's just looking for a man and breaking somebody's home. So when I asked the Investigator General, she said, well, how come so many months have passed and you haven't responded? And then he was of the thinking that I was silly also for having done that. So he hid behind the Women's League and said, the Women's League, you wrote to the Women's League. So they're the ones dealing with it. I said, by the way, they are not doing anything with this. And you, even if they would do something, you should also do something. From what I know, the Ombuds person is supposed to do ABCD, you know, and listed all those things, I thought. And there was silence, but a month later or so, there was a reply inviting me to a tribunal to go and state my case, because he realized that actually I was right. That was the area where they could operate. So I went, I gave the evidence, I was the only witness in the court, didn't call anyone else. And again, a year or so passed, they ruled in my favor, and somehow he thought maybe I may not believe him, because he also attached a letter which he had written to the Minister of Tourism, instructing him to tell the hotels that they are actually breaking the law. Although one of the hotel association man wrote back and said, you know, he didn't think otherwise. But I was so happy. I was so happy, you know, that telling off people won't happen. But 8 years later, the same thing happened to me in the same hotel, except that this time I had entered and I ran a workshop for the whole day, like this one, that where we do various things on women's rights, because we just had our multi-party elections in 1991, and the opposition, one of the major opposition won. And we as women had done observation, and we took this as an opportunity to see what the elections meant for women. And we've been talking about it, but I had done a consultancy where we had analyzed what it meant for women and what it didn't mean, and how we did well or we didn't do. So this was I was at the height of my happiness, you know, doing things on the ground, and we came up with very good resolutions. One was to go to the president and demand all sorts of things, including that the remaining MP nominations he's going to have, they have to be women, because most of them were men, and that he was in the process of getting ambassadors to make sure that it was 50-50. So I was really riding high. Roy, we had done the consultancy together. Roy is my husband, just sitting there. We done the consultancy together, so we were the main presenters and things like that. So he was having withdrawal symptoms, I think. You know, he needed bottoms up very quickly. He didn't want to wait. So I said, I'll find you in the bar. So afterwards, with my elder sister, who is about 14 years old, senior, we trotted along, you know, to join him. And we could see the bar like that as it is, and as those colleagues seated like that, and Roy was one of them pitched to the bar. So we're rushing in, and this security guy comes along. Hey, you can't go in. Why? You are unaccompanied. I said, but there are two of us. He says, no, you don't have a man. And then he was deja vu again. I don't know what happened. We won that one. You know, so this time I didn't want to waste time with the security guard. They looked for the duty manager and making a lot of noise again. Then the duty manager said, come in, and explained in my office. I said, no. Is this the instruction you've given him? Yes, he's doing it. I said, fine. Explain that in court. So to hurry up the case, because once we get to court, it doesn't become quite hilarious. But we had a court case. I had a lawyer. And again, of course, you need money, as you said. But in this case, I had money to pay a lawyer, but I wanted it in such a way that it's something that we can do often. So we had just formed a women's rights legal clinic, you know, and the pro bono lawyers there. So one of the lawyers, who is actually, has got her own firm, but she also provides her pro bono services on one or two cases. So she agreed to do it on behalf of the legal women's aid clinic. And then, of course, Sarah was already looking at, we've won, because you win first round. So I thought we would win again very quickly. So this time we even put in the course, although we didn't name a figure. The council said, don't put a figure, because this is the first time. So, but we should demand that there should be exemplary compensation as a way of telling others not to, and hotels to treat people like this. Actually, my grounds was that I've been discriminated against on the grounds of my sex. There were two of us on grounds of our being female, because there was no such ruling for men. was presumably the same as when we went to the Omos. But the one little thing happened, which is really important, as I say, we just went into elections, the constitution had to be changed. So the women we had pushed for, the list of areas for discrimination had to include sex and marital status. Before then, it didn't. And that's the very reason why I didn't go to court the first time, because sex, marital status were not among the list of grounds on which you can sue someone, or you shouldn't discriminate anyone. But this time we had it accepted, so I thought that was in very good grounds constitutionally. Hence I went to court, to the High Court, and to cut the story short, the judge agreed with my grounds for discrimination. There are many more, so you will find them in there. The nitty-gritty, you know, the fact that we've been discriminated against because we were female, no such right of admission towards males. And secondly, the manner in which the fact that even previously they did that and were found guilty and they still, you know, committed to the same felonies. So, but cut the story short, you know, the judge did rule in my favor. And although Zambia had ratified the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, we had not domesticated it. But he also cited Bangalore, which is again another meeting where the Commonwealth lawyers had met, where they had stated that if a country has ratified something, a convention like this one I mentioned, CEDAW, then you could use that for arguing in defense. It can be used in defense, even if it's not domesticated, but it still had power as grounds for showing that the country which wants to get rid of all forms of discrimination is actually doing this, you know. So that was apart from the constitution. Also, the constitution itself on the other part, the hotel claimed it was right of admission. They just sat on that ground. It's right of admission. We can choose who comes in and so forth. But that, the constitution clearly stated, if it's a public place, you cannot. You cannot say you use your own way of discriminating people. People are free to go to public places. So the hotel was a public place, but they maintained that it wasn't. But it took the lawyer to cite various arguments, although it happened in the UK, but where a pub, you know, thought they had the right of admission. But it fell through to say, no, you can't. It's public, everybody's free to come in, and you cannot use these draconian rules because of one sex, and in any case, who chooses which sex to be born with? Something that you are landed with, just as who chooses what color you'll be, you know. So all these grounds were put like that. So I won the case. Smiling, was very happy, and I'm sure you're quite happy that I won that case, isn't it? But there was one little aspect when it came to show that actually it happened, one. But we've won, but there is still one little thing we haven't yet gotten there. That's why we have to continue to bring up such issues if they turn up again.